I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The statue of former Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo will be moved from its current site, and WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that it's not yet clear where it will be going.
Mayor Jim Kenney says input from about 4,000 people, both good and bad, was the impetus to move the Rizzo statue.
I was not a fan of Rizzo, so I could have said take the first day, say take the damn thing down, but I didn't, and I wouldn't. There were many complaints that people who had a bad experience had to go into a public building to do public business and had to walk under him or see him. And it was offensive to some people. There's other people who thought he was godlike and worship him.
Frank Rizzo Jr., a former city councilman, says his mother's disappointed and feels the process has been handled poorly.
I've never seen anything honestly like this, where a press release goes out saying we're moving the statue.
Mayor Kenney's spokesperson, Lauren Hitt, says it was a mistake the Rizzo family wasn't notified. She says the decision comes because they're redoing Payne Plaza where the statue stands.
Because it is such a unique location, is it right to have a statue out there that is so alienating and upsetting to some people if they don't have any choice but to encounter it?
Asa Khalif of the group Black Lives Matter says the statue celebrates a racist bigot and a homophobe, someone who is brutal both as police commissioner and mayor.
It represented and it celebrated white supremacy. It celebrated police brutality and police violence.
Republican City Councilman Al Taubenberger is disappointed.
I would hope they will find a place of prominence for it. He was loved by many, many people.
The Kenney administration says it'll take about 6 months to come up with a specific plan of where to put the Rizzo statue. The move would require approval from Philadelphia's Art Commission. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Changes are coming to rules pertaining to teacher layoffs in Pennsylvania. As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCory reports, districts will now have more flexibility in making layoffs, and they'll no longer have to abide by seniority when they do so.
Governor Tom Wolf will allow a bill to become law without his signature that allows school districts to cite economic reasons as a rationale for furloughing teachers. Previously, districts could only slash staff by closing schools, cutting whole academic programs, or documenting enrollment declines. State Representative Stephen Bloom, a Cumberland County Republican, says that's bad public policy.
So they may eliminate the art program, the music program, the languages program, or they may close a school building, because that's the only flexibility the current law gives them.
The bill also weakens teacher seniority. The law had dictated that layoffs would hit the most junior teachers first. The new bill says schools should instead prioritize the state's teacher effectiveness rating system, which is based on a mix of classroom observations and student performance on state standardized tests.
The vast majority of our teachers are doing a good job. They're either rated distinguished or proficient under the existing evaluation system. There's a very, very small percentage of teachers, less than 2%, that are in the needs improvement or failing categories. And there would be no reason in the world we would want to keep a failing teacher in the classroom rather than a proficient or distinguished teacher.
With Kiever, spokesman for the Pennsylvania State Education Association, says experience and longevity do matter.
The concern always has been that school boards will use arbitrary and subjective criteria to force teacher furloughs.
Among teachers with the same rating, seniority would still win the day. Last year, Wolf vetoed a standalone bill with nearly the exact same language, but Republican leaders added the layoff provisions to a larger school code bill that included many other popular and non-controversial elements. Kevin McCory, Keystone Crossroads.
The nation's natural gas drilling boom has ushered in big changes in how the U.S. produces electricity. In Pennsylvania alone, energy firms have proposed more than 40 gas-fired projects since the year 2011. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusack teamed up with the Center for Public Integrity to take a closer look at how the largest, known as the Lackawanna Energy Center, has split the tiny community of Jessup.
The plant construction site, about 10 miles northeast of Scranton, looms over the region that's known as the Mid-Valley. It sparked a bitter fight for political power in what was once a close-knit community.
Look right out my front door. We were told we weren't going to see that. Okay? My eyesight isn't that good. And could you see that?
The plant is easy to see from Terry Caparo's house. She's furious it spoils her view of the mountainside, but is even more upset with the way the Jessup Borough Council seemed to welcome it with open arms. Whether it was zoning issues or concerns about pollution and property values, she feels like her elected officials ignored people at every turn.
They did nothing for us. They made fun of us. I mean, when I think of what they put us through for a year and a half, it's sickening.
That feeling has sparked a wave of political activism. Peter Larioni is part of a group of nearly 60 people opposed to the plant known as Citizens for a Healthy Jessup.
You know Pete Larioni, don't you?
They've taken on the Borough Council and Invenergy, the Chicago-based company building the power plant.
It seems like everything Invenergy wants, they get. And we just can't understand it.
Larioni was among a group of candidates who defeated three pro-plant incumbents on the council during the May primary.
The Jessup Borough did what they had to do under the law. We couldn't. People want us to say, just tell them, go to hell. Walk away from this. No, we can't.
Jessup Borough solicitor Richard Finucci says he's considering stepping down, claiming he was personally maligned over his work negotiating with Invenergy over the power plant. He says no matter which way the election goes, he'll rest easy knowing he helped negotiate what's known as a host agreement with Invenergy. The deal means the company will pay more than $1 million a year to Jessup for the 40-year life of the plant.
Now the easy part comes. Now it's about they have all this money that no other municipality in the entire state of Pennsylvania will have. No one. We're the only ones, a little town of 5,000 people, getting all this money. It's incredible.
That's a lot of money for a community with a $2.2 million annual budget. Finucci's critics say he's a small-town attorney who lacked the expertise to negotiate a fair deal. They feel the borough should have gotten more out of this once-in-a-lifetime windfall. Candidate Peter Larioni says the council rejected efforts by his group to bring in an outside legal team.
Right from the beginning, when you had all these meetings, all these battles, we never won a battle.
As head of the Pennsylvania Economy League Central Pennsylvania Division, Gerald Cross has worked with a lot of local governments in financial distress. He says sometimes elected officials lack the expertise to negotiate such big projects, but he sees a bigger problem.
I think more often than not, what hurts the local government and the officials is they tend to see local economic development projects as somehow a savior for their municipal budget.
Savior or not, the plant has already brought benefits. It's provided more than 1,000 construction jobs for the region and will eventually have 30 permanent employees. Dan Ewan, Invenergy's vice president of thermal development, says the project will be a net positive for Jessup.
We feel like we've listened to the community. We've made some changes to the project as a result of community input. And while there might be a small group of people that oppose the project, we feel like generally the community has been welcoming.
Across the country, natural gas has been rapidly displacing coal, a much dirtier fossil fuel, as a key fuel for generating electricity. And renewables are on the rise, too. Invenergy is a major player in renewables. A lot of its new projects are in wind. But Ewan says this new gas power plant is also part of the company's broader commitment to clean energy.
And clean energy means wind, solar. We believe it's natural gas. Natural gas is used to support all of our efforts in the wind and the solar business. It's a bridge fuel.
But as energy firms race to build billions of dollars worth of new gas infrastructure, everything from wells to pipelines and power plants, it's creating controversy and dividing communities. Roberto Galati is another candidate running alongside Larioni. She says their group wants to spend the annual payments of $1 million in a way that will most benefit Jessup's citizens.
None of us, first of all, were politicians.
They also want to improve transparency in local government, balance the needs of citizens and businesses when it comes to zoning. And she also feels the borough had routinely ignored people's concerns about the power plant.
The more we got to see how badly we were being treated was when we decided to run.
They're now gearing up for next week's general election, knocking on doors, while hoping to capture a majority by taking over 4 of the 7 council seats.
Hello.
Joe Munley can see and hear the power plant construction site from his house. He plans to move out of the community soon, but not until after he casts a vote for the power plant opponents.
Well, I feel good with the new clan that's going to come in, because I know all these people, and they're going to do what's right for the town.
This was a battle, and I think the battle with the election was all over the power plant. Even though it shouldn't have been, it was.
One of the council incumbents who lost her primary race amid the anti-power plant fervor is Maggie Aluni.
I don't fault anybody for having an opinion against it, and I hope they wouldn't fault me for having an opinion for it. But I just want Jessup to heal.
Whether the community heals or not, the plant is here to stay. Construction is nearly complete, and it's expected to come online next year. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania, Lackawanna County.
Companies and institutions are drawing scrutiny over their duty and obligation to ensure that women are protected and supported amid the outpouring of allegations about sexual harassment in the workplace. Let's assess public attitudes with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Does Gallup try to get at how pervasive the problem is in 2017?
We do. We found we had asked that question back in 1998 in terms of the number of women who face sexual harassment in the workplace. We just re-ask it. Now, these are brand new data, and certainly the percent of Americans who say it's a major problem has jumped up. Half of all Americans said it was a major problem back in 98, and now that number is 69%, so it's up by 19 percentage points. And there is still a gender gap on this. 73% of women say it's a major problem, and 55% said it was a major problem back in 98. Men, it's now 66%. So a slightly higher percent of women view sexual harassment in the workplace as a major problem now than do men. And both genders are much more likely to say it's a problem now than back in the Clinton administration, 1998.
Though, how can we get at whether the threshold to regard an interaction as qualifying for sexual harassment has changed in that interim?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because we can't with these data. It's possible that the actual behavior in the workplace hasn't changed, that people are just becoming more sensitive to it as all of these issues have come forth in the news media over the last several weeks and months.
Though, again, it's fair to generalize that both men and women now say that the workplace is not yet sensitive enough to the potential for these problems.
That's right. Although it was very interesting back in 98 when we asked that question, we actually found a plurality of both men and women saying that the workplace was too sensitive. People in the workplace are too sensitive to the problem of sexual harassment, believe it or not. Now, a big flip. 63% of women tell us that people in the workplace are not sensitive enough to this whole issue of sexual harassment, and a slight majority of men say the same thing.
Frank, by the time we next speak, Donald Trump will have marked 1 year since the momentous 2016 presidential election. Let's explore this hypothetical. Given what's intervened in the 365 subsequent days, could he win again now?
It certainly would be possible. For one thing, Trump was the most unpopular person ever elected to the presidency when he was elected last fall. So he was unpopular before he was elected. That hasn't changed that much. And also, we know that his support, his core support, which was really instrumental in his winning the Electoral College in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Minnesota and so forth, that core support has stayed very solid. So it's possible we would see the same kind of disproportionate turnout in some of those real key swing states, and he could win again against Hillary Clinton.
Frank, the government last week released some of the remaining documents pertaining to the JFK assassination back in 1963. And with that, let's open up the topic of conspiracy theory.
Dave, people have always been fascinated by the idea that it was more than a simple lone gunman up there in the Texas School Book Depository on that fateful day back in November 1963 in Dallas. We've had points in time back in the 70s and even in the as recently as 10 or 15 years ago where over 8 out of 10 Americans said they thought that others were involved in a conspiracy, not just one man, like the Warren Commission said. Now, the last time we updated this was on the anniversary of the assassination back in 2013. And at that point, 61% of Americans said, aha, a conspiracy, more than one person. And only 30% agreed that it was just one person, Lee Harvey Oswald. So even today, we have a lot of Americans out there who say there was a conspiracy. And I looked at the number just before we went on the air back in 2013. Young people, none of whom were alive when Kennedy was assassinated, are slightly more likely to think there was a conspiracy than those of us who are older.
Sounds like across time there is an enduring interest in a good conspiracy theory.
I'm not enough of a psychologist to be able to figure out why that's the case, but we human beings seem to be hardwired to like the idea that there's these nefarious goings-on in a lot of these highly public incidents and less likely to want to just accept some simple explanation when these kind of things occur.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. This weekend, a Presbyterian church in Philadelphia's Chestnut Hill section will premiere a new piece of choral music written by a Pulitzer-winning composer. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the church commissioned Lewis Spratlin to write a piece about gun violence.
Every year, the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill has a festival of music and the arts, but this year it did something new. It asked all the artists, writers, and composers to create something related to gun violence. The church's music director, Dan Spratlin, asked his father to write something. Lewis Spratlin won a Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for his opera Life is a Dream. This new work, called Unspoken Words, is meant to evoke the act of gun violence. Lewis Spratlin composed the choral piece to be accompanied by trombone.
It's capable of being very violent, I think. There's a lot of clangor in its sound. It also can have quite a tender quality in the movement of that blood. Boom, 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 boom. It's a part, basically.
Spratlin composed the piece in six parts called gun, bullet, finger, body, blood, and siren. In the blood part, the descending harmonies are meant to evoke pooling blood. The concert on Sunday afternoon will be just part of the Festival of Music and the Arts. Saturday, there'll be a reading of a new play based on the shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. That's when 20 children were killed. There's also an art exhibition of portraits of victims of gun violence. The co-curator, Rebecca Thornburg, worked with the activist group Heeding God's Call to End Gun Violence to pair 21 artists with families of shooting victims, including two police officers.
The intent was not to talk about their unfortunately violent deaths, but rather the joyousness of the lives they lived, and to contemplate what their future could have been had their lives not been cut short.
The festival at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill is free. However, donations collected during the weekend will go to Heeding God's Call. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Down and dirty sections of North Philadelphia serve as the backdrop for a gritty look at life, love, and loss in the film Flesh and Blood. Just in town this afternoon from his home in Los Angeles for tonight's opening in Philadelphia, and joining me now is director, writer, and star Mark Weber. Mark, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
The film opens in a scene with you getting out of prison, and you are picked up by your mother, one Sherry Honkala, who's also joining us this afternoon. Sherry, thanks for being here as well.
I'm thrilled to be here as well.
And we'll talk about the film, but Sherry, my question for you is, for those who juggle activism, politics, and acting, isn't it more typically the route that you're an actor first and then you dabble in activism and politics? You seem to be doing it the other way around.
I think my whole life is goes down a road by any means necessary, especially when you've been, one of the longest living single moms in America.
So, Mark, how did you encourage your mom to go down the road that we all travel in this film?
I just called her up and I said, Mom, you got to do this. And she said, yes. This whole process, this film is a huge gift to me and for everyone involved, really.
The subtitle of the film is We Build the House We Live In. What house are you referring to?
What we depict in the film is there's a lot of trauma and pain that's kind of lurking from my mom's past and my past and our current lives. It's taking a look at that pain and trauma and how that's kind of built us into this story that we tell ourselves, that we basically unpack throughout the film.
You know, it's great having you and your mom here, but the real star of the show is your half-brother, your other son, Guillermo Santos.
Yeah.
He's not with us now, but I think we have queued up a scene in which he is holding forth.
That's why I want to start out with the documentary, to teach and show others about what happens to me and to, I'm sure, a lot of kids.
Okay, so Mark, you're out of prison. You scrape together enough money to give your brother a camera. Mm-hmm. And so then he can make more sense of his life. And Sherry, if I recall in that scene, you're beyond the wall listening to his poignant self-reflections.
Absolutely. And, you know, Guillermo is Guillermo, and he doesn't bite his tongue, and he speaks his own truth. He really was going through many of those things in the film.
Is that truly his father in the film?
Yes, that's his father, as well as Mark's father in the film.
And so at what point is the viewer dispensing with reality? Because this is not merely a documentary. It's a, what would you call it, docudrama, a narrative?
I call it reality cinema.
And so how would you encourage the viewer to approach it? Because you could easily get seduced by merely the mother-daughter, mother-father, father-son relationships.
I love it when people who watch the film who don't know it's really my mother and really my actual brother and our fathers in the film, how moved they are just on the face value of the film. And then also people who know going into it that this is a real family making a fictional narrative film based on the reality of their lives. And that's a fascinating way to go into watching the movie as well.
You will only have to guess which is real and which
right.
is not.
Which is the exhilarating fun part of working in a space that is different in this way. And sharing it with audiences and seeing the emotional impact that it's having. And beyond that, the discussion with other filmmakers and other artists about, oh wow, this is a new genre. This is something that's starting to happen now. And that's really, really exciting as a filmmaker to talk about things like that.
Discussion about the genre, but discussion about the content as well. And following tonight's screening at the Prince, there will be that opportunity for those in attendance. So, Sherry, what aspects of the message do you hope to impart? And joining you will be your presidential running mate from 2012, one Jill Stein.
You know, Mark can talk about building the house metaphorically. I'm talking about it concretely. Here in Philadelphia, I'm dealing with a whole host of families right now that don't have any place to go. And we are concretely trying to build houses and trying to figure out a way how to house them for the holidays.
Coming back to reality, this film is dedicated to your three sons. Is that consonant with the theme of life does go on and we can transcend the grit and the issues that might otherwise keep us down?
Yes, 100%. Totally. I'm very interested in making films that are not bleak, that are not hopeful. We explore a lot of real pain, a lot of real trauma, a lot of real suffering, but it's ultimately a very hopeful film.
We've admittedly and intentionally in our time together not devoted too much to the specifics of the plot line, though we might encourage viewers to take it in while it's still here in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for being here in advance of tonight's screening.
Thank you.
Mark Weber, Sherry Honkala on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director is Eugene Son. Our Assistant News Director, Katie Colinari. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.